for today's session was on the possibility of a Jewish democracy in Israel. Now, I don't need to tell you, of course, especially in the last few months, this has become a very, very hot topic, both in Israel and outside of Israel, as people all over the world, Jews and non-Jews alike, are responding to certain initiatives and counter-initiatives that the government or sections of the government have initiated regarding the coherence or stability or validity of Israel's right to be recognized as a Jewish democracy. A lot of people talk about this subject matter, and sometimes one, like many other subject matters, experiences an inverse relationship between vocality and knowledge. And a lot of people share their opinions. Some are more learned, others are less learned. And I found it to be an acutely important topic to pass by without giving it some sort of attention, and also share with you or discuss with you the context of this debate, the way I see it, of course, not my take on it, in order for us to launch into a meaningful discussion about the trajectory of Israel as a Jewish state and as a democratic state. And I tell you right from the get-go, this is going to be it's a volatile issue. It's you'll see. It's sensitive. It's loaded. It doesn't come without its pack of problems. But as I always try to show you, if one tries to tackle a subject matter without due context, one sometimes loses the conceptual forest for its terminological trees. So we are trying, first of all, to understand the concept. So today's presentation is going to be divided into three parts. The first part, I'm going to suggest five ways which determine the perception of Israel, the concept of Israel, the land. I'm talking about the land, not just the people over there. The land of Israel. Five ways to tackle that concept. And those five ways are Israel as an anticipated landscape. The second one is Israel as a covenantal landscape. The third one is Israel as a remembered landscape. The fourth one is Israel as a lived landscape. And the fifth one is Israel as an envisioned landscape. The second was covenantal. Okay, so we have anticipated, covenantal, remembered, lived, and envisioned. All of which are part of what I will try to show you, the ongoing Jewish discourse about Israel and its role. The second part of today's session will deal in broad brushstrokes with the Jewish response, mainly in Europe, the Jewish response to the emancipation, the Haskalah, as we call it, enlightenment, and what are the bearings of that response or the responses. I will show you four responses without which we cannot even begin to understand world Jewry in general, and Israeli Jewry in particular. And what are the implications of those responses to the establishment of Israel and to the nature of the state? And last, but not least, we'll deal with a secular document that is a canonized document nonetheless, and that is Megillat Atzmaut, Israel's Declaration of Independence. And we'll try to show how Israel's Declaration of Independence, which, by the way, was composed very, very quickly, in a few days, tries to, in so many ways, to articulate or bring into the discussion all the five landscapes which I'm going to talk about in the first part of the session, and to bring into dialogue all the different segments of Jewish response to the Enlightenment and emancipation, and why I argue, at least, that the type of liberal democracy a la Western Europe or the United States or Australia will be profoundly difficult to achieve in Israel, and why there is a reason, at least an argument for a reason, for Israel to try and articulate a democracy, but a democracy that does not force it to let go of its Jewish character, and we'll see what that means. So obviously, right from the conclusion of what I'm talking about, you see it's going to be a difficult discussion. Was this clear, the introduction? Okay. So let us start now with part number one, and we'll deal with the first segment of part number one, and that is Israel as an anticipated landscape. When we look at the biblical narrative, or more precisely, the Pentateuch, the Torah, the five books of Moses in the Jewish narrative, we find the land of Israel, and I'm not talking about different names as Canaan and others, but we find the land of Israel as being associated first and foremost with a number of patriarchs. And then we find the land of Israel as being associated with the people of Israel once they are formed as a nation after the Exodus from Egypt. And then we find something very, very interesting happening. If you read what is being told after the event in Mount Sinai, and the very, very lengthy, right, exposition of mitzvot and what you're supposed to do and how they pertain also to the land, you find something very peculiar and very fascinating that happens in the Torah. And that is that the people of Israel receive very detailed information and instruction about a land which they had not yet seen, a land which they had not yet experienced. Everything we learn about from the Torah about the land of Israel, from the Torah about the land of Israel, when it comes to the people of Israel, is being given in Sinai, outside that land. In other words, what we find is a very, very interesting phenomenon. We find a relationship that is being established between a people and a land, not based on familiarity, but rather based on anticipation. That's why I called Israel a land. I'm using the language of the author of Narnia.
C.S. Lewis.
Israel is described in many ways as a land of deep magic. It is profoundly different from the place from whence you came. There is something different waiting for you there. We'll talk about it in a minute. It is a land that has an intimate relationship with your God. And I'm taking you back now to our first session, if you remember. And a lot of the things today are going to tie with all the sessions we discussed, hopefully. It is a land that requires one, as a Hebrew, later to be called a Jew, much later, to be very, very attentive to the covenant that one has with God, because that covenant also applies to one's relationship with the land which one has not yet seen. There is a build-up that takes place in the Torah. You can call it a positive build-up, a negative build-up, but it's a build-up, and it comes to full fruition at a moment when one saga ends and another one begins. The death of the prime leader Moses on Mount Nebo, overseeing or seeing the promised land. And once the people of Israel pass that line, move from the Sinai desert into the promised land. Once this pledge is realized, we also leave the Torah. We start with the book of Joshua, In other words, the Torah in many ways is a build-up towards a realization of the relationship between the people of Israel and the land of Israel. It is an anticipation that is not based on knowledge. And mind you, that many of the Hebrews, at least according to the narrative, and I'm talking about narrative here, not about historical facts. I don't care so much about historical facts. I care about the story as it's being given. A lot of the Hebrews who left Egypt and on their way to the Promised Land never made it to the Promised Land, either because of natural causes or because of divine decree. But they never made it. It remained an anticipated land for them in life as in death. But from a national memory, from the aspect of national memory, there is a profound role to Israel as a land whose importance does not only rely on immediate familiarity. It is a land one anticipates to see, one builds into, but doesn't necessarily come into contact with. It's part of the narrative. This is one thing that I want you to entertain in your thoughts. Israel as an anticipated landscape. Once we move into the book of Joshua, into the prophets, the section that is known as Nevi'im, we look at all the different books that talk about the monarchy and then the divided monarchy. What we see here is we see the attempts to realize that anticipated land as a covenantal land. Now I'm going to borrow again from another lecture that I gave you, where I tried to explain to you what I meant when I talked about Israel as a covenantal landscape. Anybody remembers the examples that we gave here? I gave at least three. I'll give you the first one that I talked about. I talked about circumcision. You remember?
Yeah.
No. That was when we talked about the Hebrew. Here, that was when we talked about the fruit, right? The orla. You remember the foreskin of the fruit of the tree, where the word that is being used there, orla, thickening, something that needs to be cast away, something that needs to be chopped off. In the biblical language, it is used for four different things. It is used for the foreskin of the penis, which is the most common use. It is used, but in all four, it is used as something, as a thickening that stands beyond and stands between a certain element and its ability to understand the divine charge and fulfill it and correspond with it. So we have the foreskin of the penis is a covenantal act that brings the male closer to God and reminds the male of his pledge to divinity, his covenantal relationship with God. We have prophets, right, who say, I wish I could utter the words of God, or I wish I could be worthy of the word of God, but alas, I am of uncircumcised lips. V'anochi arel sfatayim. Very, very powerful. Arel sfatayim. My lips are uncircumcised. I am not able to convey the divine message with all of its accuracy, potency, beauty, depth. In other words, I'm not worthy. But the language here is important. Another one that will be used extensively by Christianity is the thickening or the foreskin of the heart, which will later be used by the forefathers of or the founders of Christianity as the new act of circumcision. Cut off the foreskin of your heart rather than the foreskin of your penis, because this is where you should do the foreskin. In traditional Judaism, there is no contradiction between the two. But at this juncture, I want you to remember that the word orla, arelei lev, people whose heart has a foreskin, people who are uncircumcised in heart, is also used. And the last one, which we talked about, the foreskin of the fruit of the tree, fruit-bearing tree in the land of Israel. This is the only time it is being used. Okay? So the land of Israel, or the fruit of the land of Israel, are fruit that undergoes a symbolic act of circumcision because before it is worthy of being presented to the Kohanim, and later on the fifth year, being edible. The second example, do you remember now? What was the second example I gave when we talked about Israel as a covenantal land or a covenantal landscape? Shabbat. And I remember referring you to the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, chapter 25, verses 1 to 25. It deals with Hilchot Shemitah. By the way, the word Shemitah doesn't appear in the Bible. It is a later word. But if you remember, and I mentioned that here, the commandment to allow the land rest every seventh year is rendered in the biblical language, allow the land to keep its Sabbath. V'shavta ha'aretz Shabbat la'Adonai. Okay? Allow the land to keep the Sabbath in honor of God. It's beautiful. That's why translation sometimes is so problematic. Okay? Now, why is that important? Again, Shabbat is a major covenantal act in Judaism. Every Jew is expected to keep Shabbat. But so is the land. The only difference is the period. Not every week, every year, every 7 years. And then, right? Another thing, and I gave you a third example. Do you remember? Tzedakah. And do you remember how we defined tzedakah in this class? Justice, more than justice, because the word justice actually means tzedek. What is tzedakah? There is a difference between tzedek and tzedakah. It's subtle, but it is important. Tzedek is a tools or a means to a higher end, and the higher end is tzedakah. And tzedakah in this context is the social attempt, the social and ethical attempt to bring the different social elements into harmonious utility. Elevate the poor, humble the rich, elevate the humble, humble the powerful, whatever. The language varies, but the idea is to remind the different players in society that there is a sense of equality, existential equality before God. A human being, by definition, is equal to all other human beings. In other words, there is no preference in the eyes of God in that respect. Tzedakah is the multi-layered social attempt to achieve this kind of goal. Now, in the biblical language, who are usually the ones who are associated in the prophetic language, in the biblical language, with those who need to be elevated? Ger, yatom, halmana, evyon, dal, all the words that deal with poverty, lack of accessibility to points of power or to centers of power, right? Orphans, widows, right? Those who need help, in other words, right? So society is supposed to help them. The Jew is supposed to help the poor, to help the orphan, to help the widow. So is the land. And I gave you examples here of Leket, Pe'ah, Ushichecha, if you remember. The land is now the Jew who works the land, right? You all know what I'm talking about. Forgets something in the field. He's not allowed to go back and pick it. He's not allowed to go back and harvest the corners of his... Yeah, not allowed. Leave it. Azavtam lager, leave it for them. Allow the land to take an active role in the act or the mitzvah of tzedakah. So here are three examples that now present the land of Israel as a covenantal land. Now I want you to understand the phenomenology of what I just talked about. And what do I mean when I say phenomenology? The actual manifestation in daily life of this big concept. So here is an example for you. Let's say that we, and remember when we talk about the biblical language, when we talk about the Exodus from Egypt, blah, 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 we talk about highly agricultural societies, right? Obviously. Let's say for a second that you and I traverse the Sinai desert. We came from Egypt. We remember Egypt as farmers, as people who work the land, till the land, tend to the land. And we come now to this other land, to this Narnia, which already abides by the laws of Shemitah. Okay? And we stroll through the fields, and we see a lot of green fields with corn, with this, with this, with this. And all of a sudden we see a region that is barren. Brown, waste, nobody touches it, nobody comes close to it. It lays barren in the middle of this vast greenery. What would you think immediately, intuitively, what would you think if you came from a, again, so-called normal agricultural society? What would be the first question that you ask your Jewish brethren when you see that patch of land?
Who does it belong to?
Who does it belong to? But what would you ask about the land itself? What's wrong with it? Is there a sickness? Is there a disease? Is something wrong? Otherwise, how come there's no corn there? Now, you would be amazed to hear all of a sudden that this land is not sick, but rather it is extra sanctified. It is extra sanctified. The land is now keeping the Sabbath. And if you remember the biblical language, it says, do not worry about the quantity or about the quality of your harvest, because I will compensate you in other fields for the ones that is not you being told. So there is some sort of, again, tzedakah, equanimity that God promises the people of Israel if they follow the rule of Shemitah. But in the eye of a foreigner, of somebody who is not part of that covenantal language, something is definitely wrong here. The land doesn't abide by the same rules. And the same geography, the same landscape is now interpreted in a very, very different way. It seems as if it is barren. But in fact, once you understand the context, it is extra sanctified. And by the way, from a legal standpoint, from a conceptual and legal standpoint, the rule of Shemitah, of letting the land rest, letting the land go, runs parallel to the rules of Nidah. Of female purity. The female is not deemed impure or unclean in the negative sense of the word. Not at all. The female is deemed somebody who undergoes a periodic cycle, and at that point she's actually extra sanctified. And by the way, the Talmud, for example, when he talks about Nida, it says something beautiful. It says, and why is the husband required to, again, let go? Yeah, right. Not to have any social, any sexual contact with the wife. They don't say because she's unclean and impure, and you shouldn't touch her, and she's disgusting. Not at all. Sheterae lo midei chodesh bechodsho kekala bechupata, so she may look as if she's a bride coming from her, coming from the bridal canopy every month anew. Don't use it just because it's there. Understand that it undergoes a certain cycle. And in the case of the land, it's a covenantal cycle, just as in the case of female purity, a covenantal cycle. So here is another example now, three examples that we gave to explain the idea of Israel as a covenantal landscape. Now, the reason I'm saying this, guys, very important for the third part of our discussion, because according to this view, one cannot divorce the land from the other elements of Jewish identity and identification. I want you to I'm not talking about nationality, I'm definitely not talking about nationalism. I'm talking about the land, the idea of a specific landscape that abides by a specific covenant that requires a specific people. This will be a very powerful point and also a very problematic point, because in many ways it's unique, or at least different. So this is the second kind of landscape that we are talking about. After the first and the second exiles, the first being at 586 BCE, the second being at 70 CE, we're talking about the period between the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second, its major renovation by King Herod, and then its destruction at 70 CE. And last Sunday, if you remember, we talked about that year as a paramount juncture in the movement between Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. Those of you who are here remember. After the exiles, Jews are now dispersed from that covenantal land and are trying to find ways to complement this exilic condition. How do you now maintain a relationship with the land, albeit being outside of the land itself? What do you do?
Memory
is one, of course, and
ritual.
And Judaism has turned memory into an art form, truly into an art form, and that's a whole lecture in and of itself, the art of memory in Jewish thought. Others are actually reconstructing spaces as to suggest that they are now, in a way, encompassing the sanctity of the land. They are reviving the extra dimension of the lost land. For example, synagogues, as we know them. And I told you, synagogues existed at the time of the Second Temple. But at the time of the Second Temple, they functioned as JCCs, more than what we call them today, or what we perceive as a synagogue. But when a synagogue now starts to see itself as a mikdash me'at, which, by the way, is taken from the book of Ezekiel, the term small sanctuary, but literally it means small temple. And then the structure of that space comes to resemble the big temple, right? On what wall do you face? Which one?
Israel.
No. The one that faces Jerusalem. What you just said, right? No. You're right. But what you just said, okay. Now, if you already said that, let me show you how this perception has integrated itself into another canonized text in Jewish history that we all recite, we all stand for, we all admire, and very few of us actually criticize, and that is Israel's national anthem. Kol od balevav pnima nefesh yehudi homia ulefa'atei mizrach kadima ein letzion tzofia. That's a Western anthem. For an Egyptian Jew,
doesn't work if you're Yemenite.
Exactly, it doesn't work if you're Yemenite. If you are an Egyptian, if you're a Bukharan Jew, and you look to the east, you'll see China. And don't give me the rabbinic dictum, but the world is round. And if you're an Egyptian Jew or a Jordanian Jew, at the most, if you look to the east, you'll see the back of your frustrated Bukharan brethren. And if you look, for example, to the Talmudic synagogues, if you go to Gamla or you go to Arbel in the north, it will be the south. If you go to Masada, it will be the north. If you go to Syria, it will be the west. In other words, it's not east, it's Jerusalem. And by the way, I wrote an article about this and even suggested to change it by law. But by Israeli law, there needs to be an overwhelming majority to change a line in the Tikva. And that will be an interesting ordeal. But in any event, here is an example for you how a specific narrative of a specific people now becomes the overruling narrative, although it truly does not reflect the Jewish reality of the time. Okay, there are Jews all over and not just in the West. Okay. Now, when Jews dispersed and started building spaces and sanctifying times in this perpetual memory of the land from whence they came, Israel becomes, from a covenantal land, to a remembered land. Now, I want to make a distinction between a remembered land and an anticipated land, because actually, there is a point of confluence between the two. If you remember a certain land, you also anticipate to be there one day. For example, say, L'shana ba'a b'Yerushalayim. However, unlike the anticipated land of the Exodus, where you are anticipating a land for which you have no collective memory, with a remembered land, you are building your anticipation based on a collective memory. You understand the distinction? In other words, people are now referring to those who had actually lived there. To those who had actually lived there. They want to return. They want to reestablish. They want to revive. All of which are words that will have profound importance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in a way, you could say it was a remembering because they had been here before. Their ancestors had been here before. They're coming back.
That's why I made the distinction when I said we're talking about the role of the land of Israel once the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, have been established as a people. You don't have a people yet. You have a people at the Exodus. Then you have a nation of a people who now start establishing a relationship with this land which they had not seen.
Yeah. And coming to see the land and seeing it barren. So was land actually practicing Shemitah as pre coming out of Sinai? So pre us receiving the Torah, so whoever was here at the time was practicing Shemitah?
Very, very good question. And it depends who you ask. I'll give you an example. Did Hebrews keep the separation of milk and meat before Torah was given? What do you think?
Avraham Avinu did.
Okay. In Avraham Avinu's case, we see not. Now, but there are rabbis who tried to find an excuse for that and explain what happened. However, we do have those who say that they knew the Torah and they followed it. But again, I'm making a very clear distinction between the revelation that was given to patriarchs, or sometimes through matriarchs, and certain revelations that were given to individuals, and to the revelation at Sinai, which is the point that distinguishes between Jews and other theological structures such as Christianity and Islam. So, if we're talking about Sinai, we're talking about the moment where Torah was given and unpacked. And then people started understanding what is expected of them. Whether it was kept by others before, it really depends who you ask. I deem it at this juncture an irrelevant question. It's a question for a debate that doesn't have serious bearings on what we're talking about today. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so what we have now is we have a millennia, and over a millennia of memories that try to create a link between the land that was experienced at the days of the covenantal landscape and the land of memory where Jews live outside of Israel. And here we find the first meaningful debate among Jews when you try to understand the difference between the concept of a homeland and the land which is home. Now, there will be many who tell you the Jews have always yearned to come back to the land of Israel. Jews have always thought about the day that they would come back and gather it under the wings of the Shekhinah and God. And da, da, da. Nice. Not true. There will be many, if you're recording this, who would now jump at this and say, wow, now we have a lot to say against Israel. But wait. First of all, let's be realistic. For example, anybody can guess when we talk about the famous Shivat Tzion after the Babylonian exile under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah and others, what was the percentage of Jews who had actually returned to Israel from those who were dispersed in the...
10%.
About, what did you say?
10%.
Roughly. 10%. And among those 10%, probably 90% were people who had nothing going for them in Babylon, so they came back to Israel by default, not because of great ideology.
Oh, sorry.
Well, first of all, you have the tribes, you have Israel and then Judea, and then you have the 10 so-called lost tribes, which is a whole story unto itself, that got, according to some traditions, got completely lost. So we're talking about the majority of the people who lived here got banished out of the land. So now when we talk about a remembered land, we find a few things happening simultaneously. One, people who try to heighten the spiritual realm of the land, of the homeland, while at the same time continuing to live in the land which is their home. In other words, people who talk about Israel as the homeland of the Jewish people, but do not necessarily turn memory into an act of commemoration, in other words, into an active act of commitment. Nachmanides, or Rabbi Judah Halevi, Libi b'Mizrach v'Anochi b'Fatei Ma'arav, my heart is in the east, but I am at the west. Nachmanides, who talks and eventually comes to Israel for a while, Maimonides, who will come for Israel for a while, they come visit, not necessarily establishing themselves. The majority of Jews throughout the post-exilic period find themselves eventually integrating themselves into the worlds into which they were dispersed. Now, there are many natural reasons for these. Israel, however, becomes now, for the most part, a remembered landscape that for many Jews associates itself with some sort of utopian future. In other words, when the Messiah comes, we will be gathered. When this happens, we will be gathered. When things happen to usher us back into the land, we will go. However, until this happens, we are staying put. Now, in closed brackets, by the way, and that's a whole lecture unto itself, what is the city that is most associated with Jewish mysticism?
Tzfat.
Great, everybody said Tzfat. Anybody knows why? Why Tzfat? What is so important about this tiny village that in the beginning of the 16th century had less than 300 families, Jewish families? Anybody thought why? Why Tzfat? Yes, there were others. You're right. But why mysticism? You could tell me it could be a commercial center. Why mystical center? Why did so many mystics and giants... Because of?
Shimon Bar Yochai.
Who was?
A mystic.
When?
After the destruction of the temple.
Of the second temple. Now, I want you to understand what happens here. In the days of the Mishnah, Shimon Bar Yochai, who will be glorified by rabbis and then glorified by the book of the Zohar, which will appear in the Spanish vicinity circa 1298-1300, Shimon Bar Yochai, according to these stories, lived, practiced, preached, and died in the Upper Galilee. In the 15th century, in the late 15th century, now 1300 years later, Jews, for many, many reasons that have nothing to do with Jews, but mostly with Christianity, internal strifes within the Christian world, and clashes between Christianity and Islam, Jews are being driven out of major centers in Europe. And by the way, Spain and Portugal being just two of many. You had Lisbon, you had France, you have many, many, London, you have many, many others, Germany, many other centers where Jews were driven en masse. Okay? At the same time, more or less, in 1517, Bayezid I, one of the first sultans of the Ottoman Empire, sees the economic and political advantages of bringing Jews, who were wonderful at commerce, bring them into the growing Ottoman Empire, says, let's settle them all over the place. They will help our economy. He had nothing to do with theological thought. He couldn't care less. He brings them into the East. Now, I want you to understand what happens. For Bayezid II, or for Ferdinand and Isabella, these are political issues. religious issues for the Spanish and Portuguese, political issues for them, completely political issue for Bayezid II, okay, the Ottomans. What happens to Jews? They are now forced to move from west to east. Now, more than that, the Ottoman Empire is the first in over 1,500 years that brings together territories that were once ruled by Christians in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and the Mamluks, the Muslims, in Egypt and the Far East. So now you have the first time where Jews can traverse freely between those two dominating religious giants and come to the land of Israel under an invitation from one of the greatest emperors the time had known. What Bayezid considered a political move, many Jews considered a divine move. God is kicking us in the ass, as it were, and pushing us to the land of Israel. Now, a lot of the leaders of those communities, and I'm oversimplifying, said if this is the move that God is initiating, and he's using Gentile giants as pawns in this divine theological scheme, whose goal is to eventually bring the Jews into the redemptive messianic period, we have to help God to do that. How do we help God? We now recodify or decode the book of the Zohar, which is the most esoteric blueprint to help God, help for us to help God help us. By decoding the Zohar, and that goes to the lecture I gave you about God, Hebrew as God's vernacular, the mystic take it to a radical, radical form. They now come and say, study the Zohar. Study it where? In the landscape wherein it was conceived according to what they believed. They, of course, did not believe that it was written by Moses de Leon in the 13th century. For them, it was written by Shimon Bar Yochai and his cohort in the 2nd century and lay dormant for 1,100 years until it was revealed through Moses de Leon and was revealed by God in order to usher in the Messianic era. So now Jews en masse go towards Tzfat in order to help decodify the Zohar and bring in the Messianic era. In other words, at that point, we find a very heightened moment of messianic expectations. And Tzfat becomes synonym with that messianic expectation. And by the way, Tzfat was a center. This great aura of Tzfat is a mystical center. People who know history will reveal something quite amazing. It's less than 50 years. Less than 50 years. That's it. But what happened on those 50 years is mind-boggling. Is mind-boggling. People believed that now God wants them to go back to Israel. And then it happens. But even then, where were the greatest Jewish centers of the world? No. Damascus, Cairo, Salonika, which is known as Jerusalem of the Balkans, right? Venice, Napoli, all of these areas. Not Israel. Even then, not Israel. So let's look at history in the eye and come and say that when we talk about a remembered landscape, the remembered landscape for most part throughout Jewish history until the modern era is a mental activity and not a physical activity. And we'll see. Okay. It will be only after the birth of the Zionist movement, and that will be part of my second part of the presentation, that people will start thinking about Israel as a lived landscape. And when I call it a lived landscape, it is the necessity to turn the remembered land into an experienced land. In other words, a lived land. And now we start a completely different set of questions. How is that to be done? How do you return to a land reviving old paradigms and needing to brush them against new necessities. The world had changed in 1900 years. What do you do? We'll come back to that question in a minute. And the last landscape is the landscape that we're dealing with today. The lived landscape that we are all part of is perpetually engaged in a discourse over its envisioned trajectory. Where are we going? What is Israel's future? How is it going to look like? What are going to be the concepts that shape it as a state? And here comes one of the most acute dilemmas. The relationship between the land of Israel and the state of Israel. Now let's move to the second part of this presentation. And that is 18th, 19th centuries. Questions?
Just an observation, perhaps. Would you say that in the description that you made about the land, these five ways of addressing the land, there is a correlation or a mirror between like a conceptual discourse also about man and Israel, man as Israel as a nation, and man as man. As humanity. In other words, I see that when you talk about anticipated landscape of the land, that there is also an anticipated concept of Israel as a nation. And then when you talk about covenantal landscape of the land, I see a covenantal aspect or discourse as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
So that in a way, what's the description or the five stages that you are describing are the mirror of what we usually have a discourse on Israel as a people or on mankind?
Well, mankind will be too broad for this discussion.
Okay,
but definitely the people of Israel, because when I talk about a covenant, when I talk about each one of these lands, I'm talking about a perception of the land by the one who perceives. And the one who perceives is the people of Israel. The nation of the No, there isn't such a term as objective discourse. Discourse, by definition, is subjective. What I'm giving you here is what I believe are five ways that the evolving Jewish discourse perceived the land of Israel and through it established its own identity in different historical situations. Inside the land, before coming to the land, after being banished from the land, wanting to return. Yeah, of course. It is a relationship between them. All the time. Absolutely. Now guys, one thing we need to remember is that for the most part, and again I'm generalizing, Jews had identified themselves not only by the covenantal or myopic or parochial covenantal relationship that they had with the God of Israel and with the land of Israel, they also identified themselves by brushing themselves against those who were not Jewish and for the most part ruled over them. In other words, by way of distinction. In that respect, anti-Semitism, which is a 19th century term, but a much longer phenomena, was very instrumental in shaping Jewish identity for many Jews. That could be a devastating claim. Because one would hope that Jews can identify themselves via positiva. But it is true nonetheless. We knew that we are Jewish because we were reminded of our Jewishness. Even those who wanted to divorce themselves from Jewish affinities were reminded at times of strife of their Jewish pedigree. What happens in the 18th and 19th centuries, and I won't get into the historical reasons for that because they have nothing to do with Judaism per se, is that the world itself, the Western world itself, tries to break free of the theological shackles of the world. It tries to break free from theological dogma or religious dogma. It tries to emancipate itself from the myopic lens that religion affords. It tries to become literate. It tries to become liberal. It tries to become democratic. It tries to become rational. It tries to become anthropocentric. Man is in the center, not God. It tries to become all those things in order to create a universal community that is now bound by the mind and not by revelation. By intellect, not by dogma. By social agreement rather than theological endowment. The intellectuals who lead throughout the centuries this kind of a trajectory also appeal to the Jews amongst them and say to them in so many words, join us. Join that mind shift. And Jews need to respond to that call. And they respond in so many ways in four different manners. The first one is yes. Yes. It's a famous modern song by a classical Hebrew singer by the name of Shalom Chanoch. Mashiach lo ba, Mashiach afilu lo metzeltzel. The Messiah is not coming. He's not even calling to say he's going to be late. I'm sick and tired of being different. I'm sick and tired of looking different. I'm sick and tired of living a different life. I'm sick and tired of being segregated. I'm sick and tired of being ghettoized many times willingly. I'm sick and tired of being reminded of my distinction. I want to be like everybody else. I want normalcy. I want to assimilate. And in order to assimilate, I have to let go of many things that traditional Judaism taught me are the very fiber of what makes me a Jew. And I'll redefine my Jewishness or let go of it completely. Assimilation. Many take that path. Many European Jews opt for this path. They want better economic opportunities. They want better social opportunities. They want better future for their children. They want things that make sense. When the land which is your home is not your homeland, and when the memory of that homeland is solely entrenched in the mind without any sense of commemoration in action. The second reaction is the exact opposite. No, no, and no. Why no? Because when I look at my Jewishness, I find that emancipation and the call for emancipation and the call for enlightenment ultimately aims to rob me of everything that I identify as a Jew. Moreover, my Jewish definition or identification as a Jew relies precisely on those elements that distinguish me from the Gentile. So assimilation or emancipation is contradictory to Jewish life. If I'm going to respond favorably to this call to join the majority, the enlightened majority, I'm basically saying goodbye to my Jewish identity. Those who would say no most radically would now say, if the walls that separated between me and the Gentile world were this high, I'm building another story. I am ghettoizing myself even further. I am distinguishing myself from others, and I dread communication with the Gentile world because the Gentile, when he or she smiles to me and invites me, is tenfold more dangerous than the Gentile who hates me. It's a problem. That's a complex. Welcome to the Jewish world. In other words, enlightenment is perceived as a call for assimilation, but it's perceived by those who see it as a major threat. It's nothing short of Jewicide. You're actually asking me to kill myself in spirit as a Jew. That's the bottom line. That's the end result of what you're asking me. No, no, and no. We have, obviously, in the 21st century, we have those who abided by one side and those who are the voices of the other side. There are two more responses that are more relevant to our discussion today. Those who looked at the outside world and came and said, okay, let me look at the reality of the outside world and superimpose that reality on my Jewish condition. In other words, if I look at the world in which I live and I follow in the footsteps of those intellectuals who come and say, we want to break free of the shackles of religious dogma and we want to establish a proud nation, there is a clear distinction here, we say, between religion and nationality. I am a German and a Christian, and I want to break free of Christianity to various degrees, or I want to say Christianity is my religion. My religion should not touch or infringe upon my national affinity, obligation, and loyalty. Separate. Religion, one. Nationality, land, two. Don't mix. It's a wonderful book, a Hebrew book, Shachavita lo tigali basalat. I don't want the omelet to touch my salad. This is one, this is the other. Some Jews look at this. Can I say what? Judaism. And guys, I want you to understand the profound ramifications of that moment in Jewish history. Judaism, at this moment, becomes a religion. It becomes identified as a religion. It's a religion, it's a way of life, it's a nationality, it has a landscape. Now it becomes a religion, and that religion should not infringe on my national affinity. I am a German of Abrahamic persuasion. I'm a French of Mosaic faith. I'm a Jewish American.
It's how we were brought up.
My dear, it's how you were brought up and many others, but I want you to see the roots of where it came. Because this idea of identifying Judaism solely by religious terminologies is something that is adopted from the non-Jewish world. And it is adopted from a non-Jewish political environment and a non-Jewish national environment.
But before that,
people heard it was religion. And again, for many, it was something that was still lacking the landscape that makes it a holistic story. In other words, people who yearn to go back, but again, as I showed you, in history, remained in the land which was their home, but still maintained that Israel is their true landscape as Jews, whereas they are in exile. It is not a coincidence that it is the 19th century that will start introducing into the Jewish political arena the term diaspora rather than exile. Because exile, by definition, suggests something that is temporal and is not happy with its own reflection. Diaspora is a completely different term. It suggests some sort of a dispersal, but it is a reality. There are Jews in the land and there are Jews outside of the land. And by the way, the political relations between diaspora Jews in Israel and exilic Jews in Israel is completely different. Because if you say to yourself, I'm an exilic Jew, you're already suggesting that there is something unsolved. There is something that has not come to closure with your reality. I'm in exile. Exile is like a rubber band stretched, waiting to to be flaccid again in its homeland. Diaspora is now content with its reality in the land which is its home. Now, here it comes, for example. Those voices, such as Shimon Dubnov. There's a street not far from here. Shimon Dubnov, the Russian guy. Shimon Dubnov, right? Talked about the land of Israel is a spiritual idea. We have no need, not even aspiration, to realize that idea in real life. There is no need for a Jewish landscape. For Dubnov, it was a dangerous idea. Guess what? You already have a landscape. Where's that landscape? Tell me where you live, and I'll tell you where your landscape is. French, France. Germany, German. British, British. Italian, Italian. You are now creating a dichotomy where Judaism is perceived as primarily, if not solely, a religion. And the national yearning of the Jew are now satisfied by the host country. And not only satisfied, there is now an expectation of the Jew to negotiate his identity as a citizen of that nationality by showing, presenting, and advocating for loyalty for that nation. And many Jews, of course, respond to him. I mean, it makes sense. If I'm a French, I have to, first of all, abide by the French law. I'm a French, right? Dina de Malchuta Dina comes from the Jewish tradition. The law of the land is the law. First and foremost. What happens at this juncture is that for many Jews, the land of Israel is now fixed in the realm of memory, in the realm of utopia, in the realm of messianism, if at all, and is utterly divorced from the realm of realization. They try to come to a point of equilibrium between a Jewish religion and a nationality that depends on the land which is now home. Many Jews today still perceive their Jewish identity based on this kind of dichotomy. And by the way, I wanted to make it very clear, especially because I'm being recorded, I'm not judging it. I'm just giving you the evolution. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying this is what transpired for many Jews and how it informed their perception of themselves as Jews and their relationship to Israel. The fourth reaction will be the one which is arguably the more complicated one and the more challenging one. In so many words, Zionism, but of course Zionism doesn't say much. It is perhaps ironic that the fourth reaction came as a result to the failure, or at least the perception of the most miserable failure of the third reaction. And I mean here, Herzl's view of the Dreyfus Affair. Here's Alfred Dreyfus, who was the quintessential founder of the third reaction. I'm French. I'm a proud French. I have such a role in the French army. True, but I'm French. Who was reminded of his Jewishness for whatever reason, one day or another. Herzl sees it. Herzl himself is a descendant of a family who was in so many ways the first reaction. Highly assimilated. And when Herzl sees what he sees, and by the way, do not go into that, one of the most vocal advocates in favor of Dreyfus was one of the greatest names of France in the 19th century, Emile Zola, right? The famous Jacques is exactly about that. To show you that this assimilation worked, I mean, Dreyfus was admired by many French, non-Jewish, of course, French intellectuals who wanted to defend it because he was French. And he saw himself as French. Herzl, in so many words, sees what he sees and sees other things as well, which I'm not going to touch upon. This era is also the era of the nascent birth of what will later become the known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and many, many other messy issues that remind Jews that no matter how hard they try to divorce themselves of Jewishness, Jewishness is in holy or not holy matrimony to them, whether they like it or not. And Herzl now understands, and he says, if I cannot be part of you, and obviously I cannot be part of you, I'm going to become exactly like you. Convert to? There's another element where he wants to suggest to turn Sunday into the holy day of the week. And I'll explain why. Herzl now comes and says, the quintessential element for a people's survival is nationality and not religion. In so many ways, Herzl responds to the very myopic perception of Judaism as a religion of the third reaction. And he now sees the presence of national absence in the third reaction, and he turns that absence into the backbone of his Mishnah. And I'm using the word Mishnah in its most secular form. Just like a German perceives Germany as his national, and just as a French, so should Judaism have a national backbone. Not religious. It should have a national backbone. And just as France and Germany and all these places are bound by a landscape, so should the Jew have a landscape. Herzl thought about Israel, resorting to places like Uganda, the Pale of Settlement, and other places, is because of political necessities, not because of the lack of importance Herzl saw for Israel. However, Zionism will be born as an attempt to create a national balance to what was perceived as a religious imbalance, and as a way to correspond with the national shifts of Europe in the 19th century onward, where people started identifying more and more and more and more through national affinities. Now, since we're talking about Jews, it will not be late until you find Jews of every dimension of the responses I gave you joining that effort. You'll have now Zionism that speaks about a combination of religious affinity and political nationalism. You'll have Jews who will say, no, not at all, cultural Judaism. We don't want anything to do with religion. We should call Judaism by cultural terminologies. You'll have those who will borrow from the Bolshevik Revolution and Socialism and Communism and start building the kibbutzim and and give a whole new twist to what Zionism should be. Tilt the land, work the land. But most importantly, all of these Zionists, no matter how hard certain Zionist founders tried to divorce from traditional Judaism, were deeply entrenched in the language of the Jewish tradition. Why? Because for them, Zionism was to Zionism was to the pre-exilic period, just as the Renaissance was to the Roman, Greco-Roman period. They wanted to completely erase from memory 2,000 years of what they perceive now as a shameful exilic existence of the Jews. How do you do that? You revive the inherent connection between the Jew, capital J, the Jewish people, and their land. And you turn the land of Israel, with the different lenses that we spoke about, as the raison d'être for the establishment of that political national movement that will be known henceforth as Zionism. Did you follow what I just say? In other words, the raison d'être for the state of Israel will be nothing less, and not surprisingly, than the very theological religious idea of the land of Israel. Not just religion, because I said here before, the five different landscapes that we spoke about are deeply entrenched in religious and theological discourse. In other words, for Zionism, and especially for those who are religious Zionists, the role of the land of Israel now is an integral part. In other words, national affinity is an integral part of a Jewish identity, just as religious affinity. The relationship of the Jew to the land is an integral part of the relationship of the Jew to the Torah. Because the role of the land in Jewish identity comes from the Torah. In other words, one cannot divorce national affinity from the overall Jewish identity. Hence, the land of Israel must become the homeland of the Jewish people, according to this narrative. Now, if you get this, now let us start looking at Israel's declaration of independence.
Zohar, surely a central divide is the relationship of means to ends. You had Zionists who saw Israel as the indispensable place where this could occur, this renationalizing, but nonetheless, it was still first and foremost about rescuing the Jewish people.
Absolutely.
In the only place it was possible.
Absolutely.
So in that sense, as critical as the land of Israel was, it was still a means. And, on the other hand, the people who saw it as much more than a means, as an end in itself. And that defines so much of our conflict today.
Well, that's where we're going. Those who offered other places, then we have to be practical. In many words, what happened here is exactly what happened with the story of the rabbi who escaped to Yavne. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in the dispute over the future of Jerusalem. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, look, we can talk about Jerusalem until we're blue in the face. But unless we do something now to save the Jewish people, and if that means that we need to move to Yavne and then to Bet Shearim, and then we'll do it. That's exactly the same idea. In other words, there is an ideology, but there is also pragmatism. And for those pragmatists, they said, if we can't get the land, let us go somewhere else. But it was not necessarily at the expense of understanding the crucial role of the land now in establishing this kind of a national identification. In other words, the role of Uganda or the positioning of Uganda is not equal to the role of Israel. Okay? Who would like to read the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence? Eretz Israel. Okay, now you read Eretz Israel, and now you have a whole hour of context of what is encompassed in these two words. Okay? So Eretz Israel.
Eretz Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people. Here, their spiritual, religious, and political identity was shaped. Here, they first attained to statehood, created cultural values of national and universal significance, and gave to the world the eternal Book of Books.
Anybody wants to unpack this? The words here are measured. They're thought about. They have a message. They have context. What do you see here? Why do they start with Eretz Israel? Why not Medinat? I mean, they're talking. This is the establishment of the state of Israel. מגילת העצמאות של מדינת ישראל. Of? Yeah, but why Eretz? Why do you say Eretz Israel? Why didn't? Why does the text start with Eretz and not Medinat Israel? Okay, so first of all, we're talking about the land here and not the state. Important to understand. They're talking, first of all, the Declaration of Independence establishes the connection between the land of Israel and the people. The language here is, first of all, theological. Remember, the Declaration of Independence aims to negotiate between multiple worlds. The world of the past, the world of memory, the world of theology, and the world of the present, which is political, secular, pragmatic. It's not an easy ocean to traverse. Let's see how they do it, and you'll be the judge if they do it well. All right. Good. So let's see what kind of landscapes are referred to in this text, right? In this paragraph. So first of all, look what they say. Eretz Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people. Right? So they're talking about the patriarchs. They're not talking about the Jewish people being born as a people, because we know that that's actually not relevant. It's a peoplehood is a different story. But it was the birthplace of those people. In other words, it is a land that gave birth to a nation. It is truly a homeland right from the get-go, according to this. Now, what happens to them on that land? Look at the words that are being used. Spiritual, religious, and political identity was shaped. What do you see in this kind of language? Covers all the basics. And speaks to which, to whose ears? It speaks to multiple ears, my friend. It speaks to religious, secular, political, savvy. They're talking in a language that aims to satisfy multiple worlds. And not just Jews, by the way. Not at all. The world. Okay. Now look at the next sentence. Here they first attained to... Obviously the word state did not exist at that point. It's a completely different story, statehood. The notion of statehood is a modern notion. But here we're bridging the concept of statehood as it was experienced in the days of antiquity and then in the days of the first and second temple, and we bring it to bear on the trajectory of what we aim to create. In other words, the state of Israel will become a relived experience.
They could have said self-determination.
They could have. But they chose not to.
Well, we were a state.
Well, again, when you use the word state, it is a very, very loaded term. And you need to understand who is listening to this.
We had kings.
We had kings. It was a monarchy. You had actually, if you want, you can call it a theocracy even at a certain point. So what are we talking about here? Here they talk about statehood. It's an ambiguous word, right? Created cultural values of national and universal significance. National significance, what are you talking about? At least, why is this word being used, right? And gave to the world the eternal book of books. Okay, it's all nice. It's all very important. I'm not calling it a lie, but significant parts of the book of books were created actually outside of the boundaries of that landscape. So again, let's see how it is being, because we're building a narrative. I'm not judging this, but we're building... Every text does this. We're building a narrative. Okay? The second paragraph. After being forcibly exiled from their land, the people kept faith with it throughout in their dispersion and never ceased to pray and hope. What kind of landscapes are being mentioned here? Right? The remembered land. We never lost contact. Right? We never lost contact with it. Okay? Now we continue with a different... let's go to the fourth paragraph. In the year 5657, at the summons of the spiritual father of the Jewish state, Theodor Herzl, the First Zionist Congress conveyed and proclaimed the right of the Jewish people to national... How do you say rebirth in French?
Renaissance.
You remember what I told you before? Zionism in many ways... is a Renaissance movement. and it perceives itself as a Renaissance movement, renewing days of old. It's a very, very important thing. We're not talking about a discovery. And here's a major difference, for example, between the American saga and the Jewish saga. Here we're talking about a return rather than a discovery.
Reclaiming,
returning, reviving, all of that, right? Reliving a memory that has lasted for 2,000 years, okay? And then we continue, and now let's go to the second page. On the 29th of November 1947, it's the fifth paragraph on the second page. The United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution calling for the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel. Now, if you read the resolution, they never use the term Eretz Israel. They use the term of establishing a Jewish state. Yeah, is that?
Jewish and Arab state.
Right? Yeah. Okay. But here we have a very interesting take here from the Jewish perspective, which is legitimate. But it comes with its bag of questions. Establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel. What is the importance of these two lines? What is being established here besides the state? What else? Who is making this proclamation?
The United Nations.
Ah, the United Nations. So what are we talking about? We're talking about now the... Right? We're talking about the narrative that we've just established is now being endorsed by the world. Our narrative is being endorsed by the world. In other words, this is not merely our own narrative in conflict, but rather it is a narrative that is being accepted.
I see another problem.
Hmm?
It's never written, what is Eretz Israel?
Oh.
And it's not written whether... the map of Eretz Israel, that the Jewish state is in it or on it, if you understand what I'm saying.
First of all, if you look at the Bible, and a lot of people are going to take issue with me on that one, but I will still claim that if you read the Bible, you still don't come out of it knowing exactly what were the boundaries of that land. And second, in Jewish monarchies, the boundaries of Israel had fluctuated greatly. If the land of Israel today, or the state of Israel today, was the size of the King Solomon's Israel, let's just put it, would have created numerous problems with our Arab neighbors. So we're not talking about boundaries. We're talking about the concept and about the idea of landscape. Boundaries is a different issue, which correlates, but is not mentioned here because there isn't. The very idea of boundaries in the Balfour Declaration and in the UN resolution is problematic. Okay? Now let's go to the final one, the one that is being capitalized.
One more important point is that this acknowledges that there's a difference between Eretz Israel, which is all the dimensions you were talking about before, and the Jewish state. They're not the same thing, which is a basic confusion we live with today.
Okay, we'll see that in a minute. You're right? And we'll see what the impact of it is. Accordingly, we, members of the People's Council, representatives of the Jewish community of Eretz Israel and of the Zionist movement, are here assembled on the day of the termination of the British mandate over Eretz Israel. By the way, the British mandate never terminated their mandate over Eretz Israel. They terminated their mandate over
Palestine.
And not Palestine in the way it is used today. Palestine, by the way, is a Greek, Greco-Roman name, Provincia Palestina. By virtue of our natural and historic right, two fantastic words, and on the strength of the resolution of the United Nations General Assembly, we hereby declare, now look at these words, the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel to be known as the State of Israel. So now you tell me, what is the state of Israel?
In Eretz Israel, it doesn't say the whole thing.
But what is it? By definition, according
to
the...
state.
It's what?
A Jewish state.
What is a Jewish state?
It's
What is it? What is a Jewish state? Ah. No, no, not necessarily.
It really means the state of the Jewish people.
Is that what it means here? No. Arguably not. It means a Jewish state. The state is Jewish. Not a state that relies on a Jewish majority, but a Jewish state. Now, what does Jewish mean? Now we come to the crux of the matter. Now starts the real issue, my friends. Because now we ask the question. We're not talking about a state for Jews. We're talking about a Jewish state. In other words, a state whose laws, national symbols, anthem, flag, all of those elements that associate in the modern world with nationality and statehood are Jewish. It is a state that whose raison d'être is Judaism. That's why I took you all the way back to the covenantal landscape, to the whole idea, in order to show you how every landscape saw an intricate relationship between Jews and that landscape. And now it brings the Zionist movement to declare Israel as a Jewish state. It is a state whose flag is Jewish, whose national anthem is Jewish, albeit not religious, but is Jewish. Its national symbol is a menorah, and many, many, many other things. Now comes the question. If the state is Jewish, and the state, by definition, has other people who are not Jews, how can that state be democratic? Because the Declaration of Independence aims to be democratic.
So it's not just a bad translation?
No, no, no. The translation is fine. You know what? I wish. I wish it were. Guys, let me make the question even more problematic. Let me make the question even more problematic for us. Liberal democracies, including the one in the United States of America, relied heavily, albeit not primarily, on the notion of separation of church and state in order to create a model that is truly, as it were, democratic, because they could divorce nationality from religion. And they could come and say, you're a Christian, you're this, you're that, that's your religion. Your religion should not interfere. And that, by the way, was dubbed by George Washington in 1801, creating a wall, quote, wall of separation between church and state. Okay? Now, this could work in Christianity, since Christianity does not have this type of a landscape. This is it. In other words, the separation of church and state does not threaten the integrity of Christian theology. The same should be, can be also claimed about Islam in so many words. They have sacred landscapes, but not a sacred homeland. So you could create a separation of church and state without affecting the integrity of national affinity or the integrity of religious affinity. What happens now if you create a state wherein the national affinity is entangled with the landscape? If you want to create a separation of so-called church and state, you're actually infringing on the integrity of the Jewish identity as it was formed. So it's very hard to make it, unless you claim, as many do, that Judaism is solely a religion. Whereas others come and say, no way. Judaism is also a nationality. You understand what I just said? So if we now come and take the separation of church and state issue, and we try to impose it or put it or try to understand the state of Israel based on that version, there's going to be a situation where we're putting it in a position that doesn't fit its own definition. So we need to rethink what kind of a democracy, if at all, can Israel sustain if it doesn't want to lose its identity as a Jewish state. I'm not saying it's not solvable, but I'm just saying here we have a challenge. You waited, and then one, two, three. Yes.
I'm not sure about the matter. I don't know the United States, but in Europe, I'm sure that religion is not surviving in the state. For example, we have Britain, United Kingdom, and it's the Queen, which is the
church.
Yeah, and then it's something, it's joined. Also in Spain, we have a regime which is consecrated for the church. And if someone is a minister or even the president, they have to they have to make something in front of cross.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, they do that. They so it's there is no separation at all. If someone like in the attack on March of many years ago. What happened? There was a state funeral which was made in a church. So.
Okay, let me respond. Let me respond to this. When I talk about separation of church and state here, I'm not talking about what you're talking about. That exists in many. There's still in Europe many, many countries whose flag is a church, whose flag is a cross. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact, for example, that France or Germany or Spain is not a Christian landscape.
Yeah.
No.
It's not something sacred and sacred.
Let me explain what I mean.
The European Constitution will say that Europe is a place with a Christian background, in which in this land, in this place, Christianity was born.
Yeah, but there's nothing endemic about Spain or France.
As
part of Christian theology. As part of Christian theology. There's nothing sacred about Spain in terms of Christian theology. You can leave Spain and you can still be as Christian as in any other, including Israel. Actually, even more so if you're in certain landscapes within Israel. That's what I mean. I'm not talking about the integration of religious rituals into the state formation. Here, you're talking now about religious rituals, and what I'm trying to show here is I'm trying to expand our discourse beyond the level that people come and say Judaism is a religion, and therefore Israel as a state should be completely like other states, and then those who want to do religion, let them do it and don't mix the two things. I'm trying to show that this is much more complicated, because Israel is being perceived as part of the Jewish identity, as part of the Jewish construction, both theological and religious. That's why. And even the Declaration of Independence, that was very careful, for example, not to mention the name of God. It uses the term, the rock of Israel and its redeemer, Tzur Israel veGoalo, after heated debates about this issue, still uses the term Eretz Israel, and uses the landscapes that I tried to show you, to establish the raison d'etre of the state of Israel. It is our natural and historical right. Historical right doesn't talk about the state of Israel in previous. It talks about the land. It talks about the monarchies before. That's what I'm talking about. It talks about the role of Israel as part of Jewish life. That's the difference I'm trying to sustain. Not the use of religious issues or that within statehood, which exists all over Europe, of course. I don't even argue with it. Well, first of all, I think that it's important to understand, and again, to put things in context. You cannot say, for example, that for Ben Gurion, the prophetic was a role model, yet it had no religious or theological manifestations. More than that, once Ben Gurion moved to the Negev, and started seeing, and Ben-Gurion himself admits, he became more and more infatuated with the Bible. He became more and more infatuated with the biblical tradition of his people. There are a beautiful story about him having a statue of Plato and a statue of Moses, and eventually the statue of Moses came to equal in height the statue of Plato. So even Ben-Gurion himself understood that one cannot divorce the land from its traditional pseudo-religious or theological raison d'être. That's number one. Second, we have to understand that we must put the Holocaust in context because it is being used in very manipulative ways when Zionism is being discussed. I personally think, and I'll say it, that the insertion of the Shoah into the Declaration of Independence is the gravest mistake this country has made. And I'll be even more blunt. It's the stupidest mistake.
You don't think that the creation of the State of Israel was primarily to act as a refuge?
Absolutely not. And I think that anybody who suggests otherwise, I think that anybody who perceives... No, the whole concept of Zionism was to relive... Not at all. This is a very... Zionists will claim... No, no, guys, there is no Zionist stream that sees Israel as refuge.
The major Zionist stream, I agree from what I know, from what I've read and studied and learned, was that the Jewish people should, like all other peoples, have a place where they would be masters of their own destiny.
Right.
And where
self-determination, right,
freely,
right,
and have their culture and tradition evolve in a natural, normal way, the way other people say it. But the people who thought that at the time did not think that those who represented the religious elements of our tradition really had very much to contribute to that. They thought, well...
I'm not sure, my friend. I'm not sure. I mean, all you have to do...
It's not what happened. You see, today we're in a situation... We're looking at this through the prism of what actually happened. And today, basically, the Dafraim, the Dosim, I mean, they're the ones who are in control.
But guys, you have to remember that, again, you have to remember that the picture as it evolved from early Zionism until the establishment of Israel is far more complicated than that. It is not a coincidence that all those so-called secular cities, the flagship of which is being Tel Aviv. It's a biblical name. Do you know that? Did you know where does the word Tel Aviv come from? Ezekiel chapter 3. By the way, called Tel Aviv because it's actually a translation of Alt Neuland. Tel means old, Aviv means spring, new, Tel Aviv. It was secular. But when Tel Aviv was built, when Achuzat Bayit was built, Tel Aviv, one of the first neighborhoods was Neve Tzedek. They built separate schools for boys and girls. They built a shul. They had a mikveh. They spoke in traditional language and did not try to divorce themselves. Even the most vehement Eastern European Jews who came after the Bolshevik Revolution, they were still talking in a language that wasn't completely divorced from their tradition for very simple reasons. First of all, that was their world from which they came. Wait. You're going now to a completely different story. Wait. What the point I'm trying to make here, guys, the point I'm trying to make here is that to see the state of Israel as a refuge is not the Zionist idea. You can come and say that the practicality of the Zionist idea was that it practiced as a refuge to millions of Jews who otherwise would have either died or assimilated or what have you. That's true. But that was not its intent. In other words, Israel was not perceived as a solution to a Jewish problem, but rather that was the practical or pragmatic solution, but the raison d'être was much, much more overriding. It was there by right, not by default. It was there by right, not because there is an urgent necessity. That's why they call it by our...
Did it happen to
Now, you can come and say that the Holocaust expedited the process. Nobody would argue with that. But to come and say that Israel is the result of a Holocaust, or to come and say that Israel, now people understood why Israel is needed, that will be a very, very dangerous thing to do. Because you miss, in my opinion, you misunderstand the very raison d'etre of the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement was based on much, much greater ideas, which some of which I just talked about today. And it was part of a national revival all over Europe. To understand that Jews must have a national identity. Not just in order to save them, but in order to come back, as the Zionists will say, to come back to the days where we were self-determined, where we were self-governed. And then starts the dialogue over... It is a problem. It is a problem, but Zionism does not come just to solve a problem. It comes to relive a reality. There's a difference in what you're saying. Let me put it very bluntly. Had not Holocaust occurred, Israel would still be established. Maybe not in 1948, but it would still be here. The timing. The timing is very different. There's no doubt about it. The leaders, the world was brought about this idea. But there's a difference. The concept remains the same concept. The timing is different. Wait. You're overlooking something very conveniently. What I gave you last week or on Sunday was Jewish pluralism. There is Jew in Judaism. When we quoted Soloveitchik, he talked about in Judaism there are two types of Kedusha. Individual sanctity and communal sanctity. Individual sanctity of each Jew and communal sanctity of the Jewish people. That does not include... And that's where the problem lies. It does not include non-Jews in that respect. Now the problem comes is what happens? The question is... The question that we have to face, guys, is what happens if we claim that the state of Israel is a Jewish state? What happens to those who, by definition, do not fall under the categories of this state or do not abide by its anthem, national symbols, and so on and so forth, yet are nonetheless citizens of the state? Now, let me rearticulate that question in the context of our discussion. What happens, let me just finish, to citizens of the state of Israel who have absolutely no connection to the land of Israel, from the Jewish lens, the land of Israel? What happens then? And here we have a major question that we need to face. If we want to call Israel democratic and apply the rules of separation of church and state and then regard Judaism as merely, as not merely, but myopically a religion, the problem can be solved. But then we have to consider changing completely the overall national character of the state as a Jewish state. We have to make it a state that currently has a Jewish majority, which is a possibility. But then it will not be a Jewish state. That can change. It can be a Jewish state now, and in 2054 it will be another state. Not a Jewish state, just a state that has a 5, 6, 7 million Jews. In that respect, it will be like Brooklyn. If we want to maintain Israel as a Jewish state, and now comes the most difficult part, we have to ask ourselves, is there a distinction between equal in rights and equal in standing? Meaning that a non-Jew must be equal in rights to a Jew in everything. Education, infrastructure, health, safety, security, everything without. And I want to, and Israel today still has a long way to go in order to ensure that this happens. Wait, let me finish the line of thought here. No. I'm talking now about Israel treating everybody equally in terms of their rights by the law, for the law. However, You're equal in right does not mean that you're equal in standing. What does that mean? Good. It means that if Israel is a Jewish state, if it is a Jewish state, somebody who does not abide by the configuration of that state as a Jewish state cannot expect to have the same affinity with its national symbols, with its national anthem, with its characteristic as a state, cannot identify with some of its language, some of its terminologies, its Jewish backbone. The question that lies before us now is thus. Can Israel configure a democratic entity without losing its Jewish identity? Or does it need to come and say to the world, non-Jews who live here must enjoy, and this is Israel's responsibility, and as far as I'm concerned, it's Israel's responsibility as a Jewish state to ensure that all non-Jews enjoy exactly all the rights, equal rights that all Jews enjoy, and we still have a lot of work in that, I will be the first to admit. But understanding that if Israel is a Jewish state, there will be those elements in the identity of the state that non-Jews cannot completely affiliate with as Jews.
But this is a... You're right. It's run its course.
However, my friend, and that exactly I want it was what you said. I want to make the point very, very clear. You're absolutely right. I agree with you completely. But in nowhere in the Western discourse do we find someone calling Christianity anything else but religion. The nature of the discourse, the nature of the debate there is between national affinity or national cohesion and religious coercion, dogma, what have you, or lack thereof, whatever. Nobody argues against that. In Israel, you can even argue against that. That's the point I'm trying to make. People can come and say, the Jewish aspect of the land itself is an integral part of my identity and I'm completely secular. And that will be a valid point, which gives another dimension of complexity to the issue, which most Western countries do not even correspond with. And we have to correspond with if we want to tackle this intelligibly. In closing, I definitely don't think that there is a solution to this, and there will be many of those who will listen to a lecture of this nature and will claim that this borders fascism or racism and so on and so forth. I think it's folly. I think it's premature. I do believe that if we want to be serious and honest about our identity as Jews, as Israelis, and as citizens, and I represent, at least for myself, as somebody who is a proud Jew and a proud Israeli, who is also who also aims wholeheartedly to live in a democratic state with the non-Jewish citizens here, we cannot escape a serious discussion about the nature of the state of Israel as a Jewish state and its trajectory as a Jewish state. And one day we'll have to face what happened in the last month in Israel is only the tip of the iceberg. One day, somebody will have to face that question courageously, and I think that it's better to do it now than to wait to a point where there will be no choice but to make a clear cut and then really border on something that is racist. And I think that if we do it and create a shared language, let me tell you right in advance, no matter what the solution that we'll find, we will never find a solution that 100% would like. But Israel...
That's Jewish too.
But it concerns non-Jews as well, whose freedom and rights are important to us. And I think that Israel cannot afford remaining either ignorant or ambiguous on this issue. Guy, this brings our five sessions to conclusion. I want to tell you seriously, especially today, that it was such a wonderful thing not to think for 2 hours about other things. I tremendously enjoyed our time together. I think that first of all, it's a pleasure to work with a group of people who are so intelligent and committed to the subject matter that we studied. The lectures that we gave here and were not easy topics. Obviously, they brought a lot of issues together, tried to give you context. But I hope, as I believe that true education is not about information, but about transformation, I hope that you leave these sessions at least understanding how hard it is to understand. And if you do, I can call this successful Alma. So thank you very much.
Thank you.